An escape mechanism is a release process by which the individual reduces pressure within his own nature by some activity or avocational interest. Escape mechanisms can be both constructive and destructive. But when the individual suffering from intense pressure seeks escapes, he very likely makes his condition worse, inasmuch as his escapes are as irrational as the conditions that brought about his pressures. The world as we know it now is a monument to man's escape mechanisms. The restlessness, the confusion, the false directives which dominate our activities all add up to the human being trying to run away from himself. He has the belief that if he can get his mind off of himself, he will then achieve inner tranquility. That if he can simply ignore his responsibilities, they will disappear. Unfortunately, this does not happen. Instead of disappearing, these difficulties multiply. Because for every problem, there must be a correct solution. And until that solution is found, the problem lingers on, no matter how we may feel about the problem. The individual, by nature and by endowments, is a comparatively happy creature. If he does not ruin his own life, he can live rather well. While it is true that living is made up of lights and shadows, pleasures and pains, joys and sorrows, most individuals are adjusted to this concept. They accept it whether it is valid or not. They accept it because they have to. Unless they take a much stronger control of their own conduct than is likely, these patterns of probabilities will endure, and the person will be moved along the path of his lifetime with the lights and shadows much the same as in the lives of those around him. The main problem that we all have to solve some way is how to carry the normal activities of life with a reasonable degree of dignity. We have to accept good fortune with modesty and ill fortune with courage or patience. But the person may not be at all inclined to modesty. He may not be especially courageous, and the chances are he will be completely impatient. Thus, instead of approaching life's conditions and situations with a relaxed internal life, he comes to face the difficulties of the day with exaggerated attitudes and more or less ruthless determinations to do as he pleases. Religion has always tried to help man to find the consolation of faith in time of stress. And regardless of whether we accept a certain faith or not, whether we join ourselves to one religious group or another, there still remains the influence of religion upon the inner life of the person. One of the things that religion should give us is a sense of duty, for nearly all religions teach that we must meet our obligations honorably. The sense of duty means that we have things to face, and we must face them according to the principles or convictions that are deepest and most real in our own natures. It becomes obvious that wherever religion ceases to exercise a powerful influence, the individual is deprived of the religious resource in his own nature. It does not really mean too much to try to prove or disprove any religious doctrine. The idea that we gain something by mentally tearing down our own faith or someone else's is essentially false and has a great deal of cruelty in it if this other person's beliefs or our own are essentially noble. The great pressure of today is increasing because the individual is not moved to recognize any source of strength superior to himself and to which he is accountable for his own conduct. The various activities of groups such as Alcoholics Anonymous indicate the beneficial result of the individual believing that the universe is good and that a power of good will work through him and with him if he will keep faith with this power. We know from thousands of years of human experience that the individual is impoverished so far as his conduct is concerned, to the degree that he loses faith in something more important than himself. For the last 50 years, mankind, especially Western man, has been losing faith. He has been losing it continuously. It has been eroded away by sophistication and intellectualism. As his faith became less, his problems became greater. The relationship between the two processes is so obvious that it is scarcely necessary to examine it. We know from our own experiences that unless we have some hope, some courage, or some conviction, it is almost impossible to withstand the pressures of circumstances. Now, what are the pressures of circumstances? They are the pressures against us by individuals whose faith is no greater than our own. Circumstances become worse around us as the faiths of other people weaken. In the end, we live in a very dangerous world in which we are practically reverting to savagery. The difference between the savage and the civilized person is his internal code. The savage probably in many instances has at least a conviction that his savagery is proper. He knows no better. But civilized man has not even this satisfaction or consolation. He cannot believe that his ignorance is necessary or that his sophistication is inevitable. It is something that he cultivates. something which he regards as a valuable status symbol in a time when skepticism is fashionable. Some come also to the destruction, or at least the enervation of their inner resources, by simple indifference. They are not actually non-believers, but they give no energy to their beliefs. Their beliefs are simply what we would term nominal. They will give a half-hearted yes to questions involving moral proprieties, but they are not inclined to inconvenience themselves to preserve their own personal integrity. If the person cannot find refuge in value, there is only the possibility of escaping into something else. The wise man, the religious person, in difficulty, retires into his own nature, not through frustration or introversion, but because within himself is a strength. And by reestablishing contact with his own strength, he is encouraged and sustained in his effort to be victorious over unfortunate circumstances. If, however, he turns into himself and finds that no strength is there, that in the process of his education or his development of a career, there has been no dependency upon inner resource, there has been no calling upon strength. If strength is not used, it is not readily available. If the individual has lost faith or never developed it, faith is not immediately available, simply because he may suddenly, in desperation, call upon it. This brings us to a very important element in mysticism. For part of mysticism consists of establishing within the self the concept of a transcendent being. The person must have some clear definition of his own inner nature, what its principles are, what its powers are, what its resources are. He must also have some inner realization that it is possible for him to be that which he earnestly and sincerely desires to be. He can accomplish this whether his desires are constructive or destructive. But if they are destructive, he simply gets himself into further difficulty. It is better, therefore, that each person has within himself an archetype of what a human being should be, and that this archetype should not depend entirely upon the habiliments of externals. The individual whose idea of what he should be is simply to be more popular, more ambitious, and more successful in his material life is not building any kind of archetype that has any meaning in it. It is no source of strength to him. A true archetype must always be an image of a state superior to the present, toward which the individual aspires. In other words, the archetype must invite growth. It must impel the person to improve, to become more than he is. But this improvement must not be interpreted only in terms of physical welfare. It is hardly necessary for him to think too much of physical welfare any longer. The state is going to take care of that. But this prospect brings very little happiness with it, because this is not the kind of welfare with which we are really concerned. Very few persons actually believe they are going to starve to death. However, welfare, in its better sense, implies well-being. And well-being always has to have a plan, a purpose, a vision, a goal, and, of course, a method of attaining these ends. We cannot have any strong image of progress for ourselves unless we have ideals, convictions, or dedications. An ideal is simply an image of a superior self or a superior state of self. It is the recognition that we can be better, not merely the hope that the world is going to be better. Convictions are strength of character. They remind us that these things which we deeply and truly believe and toward which we are willing to labor can almost certainly be accomplished. Conviction, therefore, encourages us. From the examples of others who have attained to noble state, by examples of achievement in creativity in all its fields. The musician who does not wish to be a better musician tomorrow than he is today will be a worse musician tomorrow. The artist who is perfectly satisfied with his achievement dies at the moment satisfaction sets in. The egotist who is convinced that there is nothing more that he can attain in life in terms of character than that which he already possesses has completely frustrated his own existence. In life, nothing stands still. The person becomes better or worse. And if he becomes worse and remains that way long enough, nature simply removes him from the scene. Nature will not permit an indefinite downhill slide on the part of mankind. And nations which become decadent are like individuals who become decadent. Decadence is nothing but the loss of purposes, the loss of ideals, the loss of goals, and the loss of the sense that it is possible for us to achieve. To try to counteract this type of situation, most persons in their dilemmas or in their misfortunes have a tendency to call upon their older or earlier religious training. In this generation in which we live now, there are considerable numbers of older persons who can remember back to a more secure early life. Not secure in terms of opulence, but secure in terms of value. These older persons had earlier religious training. Many of them came from devout families. Others perhaps came from free-thinking families. But this free-thinking was serious. The liberal was still a dedicated person. These same individuals grew up in a world in which religious values were firm and clear, and the code of life was simple and essentially honest. While it is true that many years have passed since these persons experienced the full force of their earlier training, there is another circumstance in life that is notable. As we grow older, we have a tendency to move backward into our own earlier living. The convictions that sustained us in childhood will largely protect us in old age. We may have neglected and ignored them for many years, but they are part of the subconscious. A simple example of something of this nature can be found in language and in music. A person who, as a child, spent a few years learning a foreign language may not use it for most of his life. But in later years, he will find that with a little effort, he can brush up the remembrance of it and can proceed with it. A person learning to play the piano in childhood may not touch it after they pass out of their teenage years. But at 60 or 65, this ability is not entirely gone, and with a little effort, it can be revived. The same is true of characteristics and conditionings. So that today, the greatest strength that our society really has is the strength and courage of these older persons who still have foundations upon hard rock. Perhaps some of them are a little narrow, some are a little bigoted, but still, all in all, they are a dedicated group of persons well aware of the importance of duty. While these remain, they will add a certain stability to society. But as they drop out, society is going to lose its living contact with these older foundations. Young people coming along have no such stability. They have no basic foundation in anything except constant change and motion. Even in physical things, this is a little difficult. Some years ago, I made a little research on this project because of a number of persons who came in with difficulties. And one family that came in had lived in the same house, in the same community for several generations. In this same symbolism, they had developed tremendous sense of integration. They were part of something. They had a certain strength within themselves, a kind of an immovable quality. Some of it was perhaps not completely desirable, but it did give them a kind of foundation on which to build, a memory of things that endured, of lives that went on, of patterns that completed themselves. Back in this generation, there were archetypes, and they became set in the minds of those who grew up in these patterns. I remember one younger person who came to me not long afterwards. This person was about 17 years old. In 17 years, his family had moved 22 times. He had no sense of home, no concept of continuity. He might just as well have been brought up in a hotel. The family did not move because it had to, but because the family was dominated by an escape mechanism. The family became bored. The family had to live on constant innovation. Only about 3 months ago, I had a young man in to see me who had not been able to complete one single semester in the same school. Now, part of this was due to inevitable circumstances. His parents were engaged in a line of activity in which they had to move with the business. But some of the moves were also quite arbitrary and unnecessary. This individual had nothing of an experience of becoming firmly established anywhere. Now, it is quite possible that this person could have gained a positive lesson from this instability. He could have recognized the inevitable and eternal motions of life. He could have realized that his own little experience is probably the experience of the end of all mankind, for we are always moving from here to there to somewhere. But unfortunately, nothing had been given to him to help him to orient in this atmosphere of motion. He was just completely confused. He could have no friends. He was never in any place long enough to actually observe the normal operations of cause and effect. He was moved about so rapidly that he was totally confused, unable to visualize any kind of a continuity in the future. So the new generation growing up has very little religious stability. It has very little sense of the importance of duty. It has not realized from experience the dedication of family to the protection of itself. They had no clear insight of the long, difficult years of bringing up young people and the dedication that was necessary on the part of the parents to give their children a good start in life. This dedication being non-existent for most youngsters today, they do not have any proper respect for unselfishness or self-sacrifice. All adds up to one rather simple but dramatic fact, that we are coming to the end of a generation in which stability can even be livingly remembered. Young people of today are beginning to show the signs of age with a memory that does not go back further than World War I. Many of them have no memory behind the Depression years, and some count their lives from Pearl Harbor. These young people have never known national, personal, family securities. What then could have supplied them with inner strength? All that was left was some means provided by society for this purpose. But society itself has been in utter confusion as far back as these young people can remember. They have received no special instruction in education or in even in religion, for the most part, by which they could strengthen their inner values. Education could have done a great deal for them, because in the impressionable years, an education made it seem important to these young people to develop ethics, to develop sense of responsibility. They would have developed these values and remembered them just as easily as they remembered the multiplication table, and many youngsters today can't even remember that. But a generation that cannot spell, cannot add, has a great deal of difficulty in reading, and has never been taught to seek beneath the surface of living for any value, is going to have trouble when outside troubles begin to gather. As they have proceeded, some of these younger people have from family and occasionally a fortunate association begun to realize their own needs. Probably the first awakening for the average young person of today is when they find themselves about to raise a family of their own. Young parents are concerned about the questions that their children have asked or will ask. Most parents would like their children to have strength of character that they as parents do not possess. They would like to save their children sorrow. They would like their children to have what they do not have. 50 years ago, that meant wealth. Today, it is beginning to mean value. Value in the sense of inner strength. So in this crisis, younger people look around, and I know a number of them that have made church associations, who have read up the subject as much as they could, have taken adult education courses, have consulted their physicians and counselors and analysts, not so much because of the desperation of their own need, as because they wanted to be able to give something of value to these children for whom they have a real and natural affection. Others who do not have this much basic stamina or insight are gradually turning into very bad parents. They are merely burdened by children. And they have nothing in their memories to remind them of the joys and pleasures of self-sacrifice in order to bring happiness and security to those they love. This situation cannot be vitalized because they've never experienced it. Thus, by degrees, society is moving from all of its older foundations to a situation in which inner resource is almost totally absent. Take a young college family of today. Both of the adults are college graduates. They expect beyond doubt that their children will also be college graduates in due time. These are good people. They are not very secure. Who is these times? But what are these young people really doing? The man, perhaps, is working. He is in some business or profession for which his education has prepared him. He is liable to be foundering around in this himself, making fairly good money, but suffering from continuous dissatisfaction. The wife is a college-bred woman. If the children have not yet arrived, she is very likely to be working herself. What are they working for? Down payment on a house. The possibility of more and better furniture. The desire to have an up-to-date car. A new television. Most of these young people have no concept whatever of repairing, mending, or putting together anything. The moment it shows the slightest weakness or sign of age, it is thrown away. There is very little resourcefulness in these younger people. And as a typical family of young college graduates, there's only a fair possibility that they may be at all religious. They are religious, yes, in a sense. They would prefer to be honest. They would like to admit that they believe in the existence of God. But these are not dynamic things. The dynamic things are the television and the car and the plans for the weekend and the celebration of various anniversaries and events. The rest of their lives may be described as rather shallow. Not much real thinking. In the house of such a young couple, you will find very few good books. Most of the things that you will find are the popular sellers of the day, preferably in paperback. You will not find in these homes any good art. This young family may be earning, the two of them working, from $1,500 to $2,000 a month. Yet there is very little to indicate any solid interest in culture. What cultural instinct they have seems to be largely devoted to modernistic furnishings for the home they hope to own someday. As they have been out of college for 3 or 4 years and have no dependents, it is obvious that they will be in debt. There is never enough to go around. They are living for the rays of tomorrow. And when the family does come, unless a miracle accompanies the children, their standard of living is going to be restricted when the young mother can no longer work. This is the pattern. In patterns of this kind, there is a very thin line of defense against trouble. If everything goes along fairly well, if inflation keeps on, wages go up, these young people will overlook the difficulties of the situation or the dangers that may lie ahead. If the young man is able to keep his job, he will complete his payments on the numerous odds and ends which he is accumulating. But if a serious illness strikes, or there is a bad economic crisis, or if any major tension arises between these young people themselves, the chances of a happy outcome are just moderate. Some of them have enough common sense to bring them through. Others, with no patience and no intention to be made miserable for any reason whatsoever, will simply break up a home on the first argument. With this kind of condition generally prevailing, the person is not only without inner resources, but does not even dare to seek for them in himself. He has put nothing in. Therefore, what is going to come out? He does not consider any particular resource within himself as any part of the equation of his life. Success and failure depend upon employment or unemployment. Happiness depends upon having what he wants. Security means that the month's payment has been made. What lies ahead should not even be considered at this moment. When life begins to become more complicated, the person under these conditions is inclined to simply run away. It is astonishing how many husbands run away within a few months of the birth of the first child. Here is a responsibility that they simply are psychologically unable to carry. There are more cases of desertion from this cause than it ever be imagined. Then there is a certain infantilism that comes into this. A young husband is absolutely unable to survive the division of his wife's attention between himself and the child. He has suddenly, to his own thinking, taken a back seat. This bruises his ego, and he has no sense of paternal pride, no feeling that he has now new things to live for. He merely has new interruptions in the so-called orderly procedure of his own life, which is largely the process of doing what he pleases when he feels like it. The same thing happens to a number of mothers. A number of mothers go into decline with one or two children. By the time the family reaches six or eight, however, they have gathered their resources and have gained certain experiences. If the family goes that far, it'll probably pull through. But these young people, they come to me. The young wife is ready for a nervous breakdown. The child has disrupted the pattern of her living. She cannot go where she pleases, when she pleases anymore. This is a catastrophe. She has no defense against it. Where no defenses exist for these attitudes and these problems, we are bound to find troubles multiplying and no remedy available for them. Escape mechanisms may also be purely psychological. They may take symbolic forms. They all arise from inadequacy. But many of them are not so honest and forthright as the ones we have mentioned. Many are so confusing in their own symbolism that the person himself who is involved does not recognize them. The only way in which a person can really be smart about this is to observe all negative symbols or symptoms that arise in his life and immediately see whether he can relate them to some tensions which have developed in an activity or area of his living. Among the more obscure and mysterious escape mechanisms are those which arise in a person to make it impossible for him to do what he does not want to do. This is a very clever procedure, and the symbolism can become extremely obscure. One form, for instance, of escape mechanism is psychosomatic illness symbolism or symptomology. The person who cannot do exactly as he wants to do settles down to a state of rebellion. He decides that if it can't be as he wishes it, he is simply not going to play the game of life at all. He is going to bury himself in some symptomology. He is going to create an escape mechanism of disabilities. All over the nation, and for that matter, all over the world, there are tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of individuals suffering desperately from ailments they do not have. Yet in many instances, the symptoms will actually deceive a thoughtful physician. Not being able to change places with the consciousness of his patient, the doctor is not able to estimate all of the circumstances that are present. If, however, an individual suffering from more ailments than there are in the medical dictionary comes into a physician, receives a complete checkup, and the doctor finds nothing the matter with them, organically or structurally, or for that matter, basically, from a functional standpoint, he is almost certain to suspect that this person is building some kind of a mechanism. He is trying to revenge himself upon something or someone. I have known cases where individuals have settled down to the rather monumental task of trying to revenge themselves against God. Now, this would seem to be a large job, and it is. Needless to say, they are not very successful, but they're doing the best they can. Many individuals try to revenge themselves upon the world. If they cannot do as they please, if they cannot be the hero, as the Duke of Gloucester is reported to have pointed out, they will be the knave. If they cannot gain the confidence of society, they will outrage it. They do not think this through very carefully, sometimes not at all. But the instincts begin to manifest themselves. The person who does not like to do a certain thing may develop illness symptoms whenever they are confronted with this responsibility or problem. The one very common one, of course, that doesn't quite reach this proportion but can be most irritating, is the individual who, whenever you try to get them to see something they do not want to see, simply becomes nervous. When they do not have their own way, they get excited, hysterical, say all kinds of unpleasant things, and frighten other people thoroughly. This is merely one way of getting their own way. No one wants to argue incessantly and continuously with such a type of person. Then we find that very often psychosomatic escapes take the form of the individual running into some excess which is symbolically consistent with his own condition. We mentioned that society is today very largely an area of escape mechanisms. And here is how some of them operate. The person who is unhappy in his personal life, who is not satisfied, whose conduct has been such that he is a failure as a human being, or is too selfish and self-centered to try to fulfill the simple, natural, gracious processes of living, gradually develops an intense success mania. Happy people really do not care so much whether they're the chairman of the board or not. The top spots in human industry and in merchandising and in the professions, in law and in politics, the top spots are many of them held by individuals who are miserable. This may be one of the reasons why things do not run more smoothly. For if authority is invested in an unhappy person who is poorly oriented, naturally the projects will not go well. So more and more the individual who is unable to find normal, pleasant living, doing simple, kindly things, buries himself in some kind of a project. If his home is unendurable, he stays out of it by working overtime. If his various associates do not hold his interest or become obnoxious to him, he plans activities which cuts him away from them. If his pressures become too great, he may not even find success a sufficient outlet. The more miserable he is, the more likely he is to become a tyrant, either in a small way or in a large way. Practically all world conquerors are neurotics, because no one in his right mind wants to conquer the world. It's much nicer to live in it and enjoy it. But the person who is unhappy wishes to find some way to forget himself. Because he is unhappy, he also wants to hit back. There's nothing a miserable person finds more objectionable than happy people around him. They in some way convict him and force him to face the fact that they have something that he does not have. Peace of mind. Escape mechanisms also run to alcohol. The alcoholic is almost always a person running away from something. And while very often the alcoholic will not admit it, it is essentially true. Now, there are many persons who wonder why some moderate drinkers become alcoholics and others do not. The answer is pressure. If, for instance, a person drinks only because it is considered socially required, he may suffer from alcohol, but he will not become an alcoholic. If another person, moved by the same original motive, merely to be a social drinker, is under pressure, he will find greater and greater temptation to alcoholism. Alcoholism is simply a phase of man's subconscious suicidal instinct. Therefore, nearly all escapes have something of self-destruction lurking in them somewhere. The tyrant realizes that he is in constant danger of being killed, and yet, as a calculated risk, he would rather gain his escape purposes and face this end, as Hitler did in the bunker under Berlin. It was the mere final culmination of the individual running away from himself. And as a symbol of this escape, death comes as a symbol of the escape of the individual from all responsibility and all condemnation or criticism. Most people have been brought up to speak kindly of the dead. And the individual who is subject to criticism, which he may justly deserve, feels that in death he will no longer be criticized. There are all kinds of obscure pressures that influence this situation. Less dramatic, perhaps, but sometimes no less fatal, is the extroversion through power. Perhaps the most common and natural symbol of that is the man with his high-powered automobile. This individual gains a sense of importance. He gains a sense of control, mastery, because he has in his keeping a tremendous machine which can be also a missile of death. The person fighting traffic, determined to pass every other car on the road, although he is not going to perhaps get home more than a minute sooner, is actually seeking to gratify the instinct to superiority. And because his normal conditions remind him continuously of his inferiority, he finds in this power drive of his car a tremendous satisfaction, a sense of triumph. He feels himself leading perhaps others who are wiser than himself and perhaps too wise to race with him. Everywhere we turn, we see these escape mechanisms. Another one is extravagance. The person who feels that if he spends more, he can spend himself into some state of superiority. He escapes from prudence, from reasonableness, by extravagance. And it is astonishing how often a planned program of economy necessary to maintain a family will end in a sudden burst of extravagance. The individual is unable to retain his sense of moderation. To be deprived becomes to be imprisoned, and everyone longs for freedom. One of the reasons why we will probably have war for some time yet is because war is a powerful instrument of extroversion. The individual who joins up has his little moment of applause. Many motives may impel him. Of course, there is always that draft, which is one motive. But there may be others. He may volunteer. He volunteers, perhaps, to escape. To escape the humdrum. To escape a job that will never be very interesting. To escape from the fact that he is not noticed, recognized, or considered important anywhere. But when he enlists, The boss shakes hands with him and wishes him well. The boss has never shaken hands with him before. The boss will shake hands with him once more if he comes back. That's when he returns. And 2 weeks later, everyone will have forgotten him. But if he goes forth with this sense of importance, he is now a defender of his country and a stout supporter of democracy, and he's now going to fight the war that's going to end war. It's always been the same. He may pass through terrible tragedies and may never come back. But still he has had his moment, his escape. It was a calculated risk. And he chose the hazardous way. Anything rather than to continue for a lifetime in mediocrity. It was Mussolini who said that it is better to live a few years as a lion than a lifetime as a lamb. And that is exactly what he did. So in all these things, escapes are nearly always poor choices. Sometimes they are wiser where the person, carefully calculating his values, seeks not an escape, but a legitimate release within the area of the reasonable. Hobbies, avocations, new interests coming into life to combat monotony. Because one of the problems that we all face in a highly regimented society is monotony. And against this monotony, there is an individuality in all of us which rebels. So we have to try to find some legitimate outlet. Most of the inmates of our prisons are escapists. And by a strange circumstance, they escaped into prison. This was not how they calculated it, but this is what happened. I've talked to prisoners in many of our state prisons, and some of them, even behind the bars, feel they made a good bargain. They escaped from something worse. They escaped from situations which they could not endure. Others, of course, used escape mechanisms because they wished to achieve at least temporarily luxuries or a social condition which they were not willing to earn or could not earn. Lured on by publicity and by very poor social standings, they tried to be great for a day. And because their rebellion was against society to begin with, they revenged themselves by afflicting society, by attacking it. This vast outbreak of attacks on persons, this rising tide of violence, much of it by persons who do not even know their own victims, represents